Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the May 2011 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast. With me this month are Laura Howes, Mike Brown and Andrew Turley, and they're here to discuss how to turn salty seawater into electricity, how clay can slay E. coli, and the world's number one chemical vice.
I sustained myself through the withdrawal symptoms, the headaches, the tiredness, the irritability, the aching muscles and joints, waiting for the promised land where I would sleep more deeply, be more focused, concentrate better, and no longer have to plan my holidays or indeed my life around the availability of coffee.
And a good 80% of the world's population are probably similarly hooked, including me. That's the chemistry and addictive potential of caffeine and coffee, and it's on its way. So put the kettle on and enjoy this very well-brewed edition of the Chemistry World Podcast with me, Chris Smith.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
They say that you shouldn't mix water and electricity, but that could be about to change thanks to a new way of extracting energy from salinity. Laura.
Well, obviously, when water from the river runs into the sea, there's actually quite a lot of entropy from the mixing and the difference in entropy between the two water sources.
Because the sea is very concentrated and the fresh water isn't.
Exactly. So people have been trying to use this to extract electricity.
I think I've come across this before, but they've been doing it with membranes and things. So you put salt water on one side of a membrane, fresh water on the other, use the movement of the ions to drive the current.
Yeah,
this is different.
That's right, but this one's different. And the way that this is different is it has no membrane at all. Instead, they're using sort of a flow of water between two electrodes. The electrode lattices actually absorb the ions, so the sodium, say, and the chlorine, and absorb them into the lattice, and then you put fresh water in between the two and the ions come out.
So you have these electrodes, they dangle into a solution. Let's say you put salt water in first. These electrodes in some way take out some of the ions, lock them away somewhere. You then what, change the water?
Yeah.
So you've got the fresh water going
in. So you've then got the fresh water to come in. So what the scientists are thinking at Stanford University, Yi Ku and his team are thinking, is that you could actually use the flow of water and the river water, so you could have it sat at the river mouth, getting the salt water ions and then using the flow of river water to actually flush out the salt water and do a charge-recharge process that way.
Indeed, sounds fantastic, but is it viable?
Well, I mean, it's working in the lab. Obviously, getting it to the river mouths is obviously a bit of a stretch. I mean, they hypothetically think that if they used all of the river mouths that were suitable, you could put a plant on every river mouth, you could make about 13% of the current energy consumption of the world.
Gosh, that's a lot. But what sort of infrastructure do you need to build? Because is this going to mean that you render a river mouth completely useless for shipping or anything else? Is this a huge, great building?
It wouldn't be a huge, great building. Obviously, you'd have to divert some of the river water into your plant, but you shouldn't have to, you know, plonk a great big building in the middle of your river, so you should still be able to use it for other purposes.
I have to watch that one. That does sound interesting. I hadn't come across that before. Andrew, from one wet thing, rivers, to another, clay, and it has antibacterial properties.
Yes, apparently, historically, clay has been used to combat various conditions, to heal the skin. And very recently, in Ivory Coast, people have been using it for something called Buruli ulcer, which is a flesh-eating disease.
Not nice.
Specifically, they've been putting on something called French green clays. And this group, led by Linda Williams at Arizona State University in the US, has been investigating what makes these clays work, or if indeed they do work, although it does seem that they do.
Is this a sort of folk remedy, then, that is now being used in a pharmacological way? People have found it does appear to work, and now they're trying to work out why.
That exactly. The clays vary in their ability to combat bacterial infections. Some of the batches are better than others. So what this group did was look at a wide range. They pulled out the one that had the best properties, which happened to come from the Cascade Mountains in Oregon, from an open pit mine there. And what they found was it's the iron in, or what they're speculating is it's the iron that combats the bacteria.
Do they know how?
They ran some tests on E. coli, and they found that the iron accumulated, the E. coli, in the presence of the clays, the antibacterial clays, had 8 times as much iron inside the cells. And they think that the iron is oxidizing inside the cells and forming hydroxyl radicals, which are destroying the cells from the inside.
So can we expect to see Ivory Coast green clays finding their way onto the shelves of chemists in the near future? I mean, are they saying this is actually practical?
I think this is probably a long way off for this particular remedy. But obviously there's a huge amount of interest in new antibacterial agents, new antibiotics. And this is one of many different ways that researchers are trying to fill that need.
I think I'll stick to a helping of Dettol in the meantime, all the same. Thanks, Andrew. And now to an extraordinary scientific feat that previously was believed to be impossible. Yes, researchers have actually found something that not only tastes great, but it's apparently also good for you.
My name is Yifan Chu, and I work for Kraft Food. We are the second largest coffee company in the world, and I am a scientist with Kraft. My area has been coffee research.
Yifan, thank you very much for joining us. Now, I've got here in front of me my cup of coffee. This is Finest Arabica, I'm told, by the company, not yours, that made this blend for me. What questions are you asking about coffee?
First, can we swap that to our brand?
Well, it depends. Maybe if you send me some nice free samples, I'll consider it. Anyway, what are the questions you're looking at?
A couple of years ago, when we are starting to look at the scientific literature on coffee, we start to notice that more and more evidence, observational evidence, suggested that coffee might have some health benefit. So that's a surprise to us too, because normally people think about coffee as a guilty pleasure that you can indulge yourself, but you have to suffer the consequences.
Are there a mixture of both health benefits and health disbenefits? In other words, are you just reporting to us the positives because it's in the company's interest to do that? Or are there clear net benefits of being a coffee consumer? I hope there are, being as I am one.
We want to portray this area pretty fairly. So the prior research have indicated some health disadvantage of coffee, but scientists now look back into the literature and start to find that all the findings are probably a little bit misunderstanding, because at that time people did not adjust cigarette smoking and alcohol consumption along with coffee. So they start to realize that if you put coffee separately, it actually have a pretty surprising finding that it's correlated to health benefit, mainly for type 2 diabetics, some cognitive benefit and Parkinson's disease.
So you're saying that many of the prior studies had other confounding variables in them, people pouring themselves a cup of coffee but then lighting a cigarette, and that some of the health disbenefits that were spotted could well have been allied to those other behaviours. What sorts of positive health benefits are associated with the coffee, and to what extent is that the caffeine, and to what extent is that other things in the coffee?
I'll take type 2 diabetics, for example. I think this is so far the most convincing evidence showing that coffee is correlated to reduce risk of type 2 diabetics. The recent meta-analysis that summarized the data show a pretty clear correlation between 1 cup of additional coffee consumption and 7% reduced risk of type 2 diabetics. On the other hand, caffeine itself is actually not good for diabetics. It can actually increase your glucose intolerance. So it's not that good for you in the short term, but in the long term, if you keep drinking coffee for 10, 15 years, the studies have been concluded that it's pretty good for you in terms of managing your type 2 diabetic risk.
What mechanism do you think is going on to help to reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes in people who do have that additional cup of coffee?
We are looking at 3 main hypotheses. The first one is antioxidant, whether coffee can help manage the oxidative stress that may be caused by stress in life, maybe caused by getting old, maybe caused by you have some food that's not that good, and that increase in the oxidative stress level in body, and then whether coffee antioxidant can help combat, bring the level back to balance a little bit. That's the first one, antioxidant activity. The second one, we are looking at anti-inflammation activity to see whether coffee can help manage that, because long term it has been shown to be very bad for our health. So we want to see if coffee can help manage these inflammatory biomarkers that in return just help us manage our health. The third part, we want to see if coffee molecule can help to manage our blood glucose, so that can eventually help us manage type 2 diabetics.
Do you actually know what chemicals in the coffee might be the key players in achieving some of these effects?
The main compound that's being hypothesized is the chlorogenic acid. There are a group of compounds that have different forms. They are probably around 10 to 15% dry weight in coffee. And also we are finding more and more evidence to think that maybe during the roasting process, some of the compound will form, and also chlorogenic acid will be condensed into a chlorogenic acid lactones. So we are still trying to figure out exactly what's the compound that's in coffee that can help manage the health.
What about the caffeine, though? I mean, that's the thing that I'm hooked on. If I don't drink coffee regularly, I do get side effects. I had a test on myself last week. I went cold turkey for a day. By about 10 o'clock in the morning, I was feeling quite shaky. By midday, I had the world's worst headache. And by 1 o'clock, I was almost asleep at my desk, and I caved in by 2 o'clock. What do you say about that aspect? Because caffeine is very motivating on the one hand, but then cynics say that the reason it's so motivating is that as soon as we have some, it releases us from our withdrawal effects, and so we can concentrate better.
Yeah, caffeine can induce withdrawal syndrome. It can have physiological effect, but it has different effects to different people. But the European Food Safety Regulation Agency just has this report about caffeine and coffee, that the only population we have to worry about is pregnant women, lactating, also very young child. That's the population we really have to be careful about. Red wine has many benefits, but it still has this alcohol. So it will be pretty similar to keep that in mind, that coffee is the same, that even though we have many beneficial components that may contribute you to your health, but there is a pretty sure acute effect to your performance day to day. So you just have to be aware of that.
As the old saying goes, do stupid things more quickly with caffeine. That was Yifang Chu from Kraft. And in case you're now developing chemical cravings for more on the science of coffee, don't despair. Catherine Holt's waiting in the wings to talk about her own experiences of kicking the habit. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, how scientists have revolutionised fingerprinting processes with a bit of help from nanoparticles, and why poplar trees might hold the key to more efficient aircon. First, though, Laura, to new insights into where the building blocks of life came from.
That's right. In 2007, a chemist called Stanley Miller died, sadly, obviously, and his former student, Jeffrey Baylor, inherited the contents of Miller's lab and office and started playing around with some of the samples he was finding there. And we've spoken before because he's been looking at vials from Stanley Miller's early experiments.
Maybe we should just remind people, I mean, these experiments were seminal work, weren't they? The idea of what the early Earth was like, putting mixtures of gases like nitrogen and hydrogen and methane into flasks and some water, boiling it up and sparking it. And you get all these interesting chemicals.
Yeah, exactly. Stanley Miller was very involved in origin of life experiments, trying to find out possible ways that life could have come into being on early primordial sort of parts of the Earth, looking at whether they probably happened in the sea or whether it was by volcanoes. And he was trying out lots of different sort of potential conditions and see whether he could spark and make amino acids and the building blocks of life.
So what is different in this experiment compared with the experiments that Jeff Bader did a few years ago reanalyzing Stanley Miller's stuff?
So the really kind of fun thing for me personally about this experiment, although it does actually give us some new scientific knowledge, is that Miller had actually done these experiments in 1958, and he'd done them in a similar way to his sort of seminal important works, but he'd actually introduced some hydrogen sulfide into the mix, and he'd sort of done all the work, he'd got his samples, but it doesn't seem that he's ever actually analysed them or written up about them.
So intriguing. So not only is it a variant on the stuff we already knew about, but it also had never been further developed, either by him or anyone else.
Exactly. So he'd actually just sort of left them. It seems like he's just forgotten about them. All the writing was in his lab books. The samples were there, all neatly arranged, neatly labelled, exactly as you should do for scientific experiments. And it's actually quite a nice example of why you should always keep your samples, label them nicely, because you never know. Someone could prove that you've been a genius and you never knew.
So they've come along and put these samples from many years ago through modern day analytical techniques. What did they find?
So they found many amino acids. One of the most important things that they found is that with the addition of the hydrogen sulfide, they've got the sulfur-containing amino acids and the products from the sulfur-containing amino acids. Miller had actually made the sulfur-containing amino acids, cysteine and methionine, but he didn't manage to do that until 1970-odd, and he did it in a different way. So this is a sort of tandem method that you could also get these amino acids containing sulfur.
It's amazing how his results continue to be generated even years after his death. Thank you very much. Now, Mike, this is a relevant story because of what's been happening over in Japan, but it isn't directly about Japan. It's a more generic thing about the nuclear industry.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. We've heard a lot in the news about nuclear disasters and what can happen when a natural disaster occurs. We've got danger to our nuclear reactors. This is talking about spent nuclear rods, spent uranium rods that are stored in nuclear power stations, and what we can do with them afterwards, how we can make them safe, maybe recycle the plutonium in them to be used again and then dispose of them.
Because after they finish being reacted in the core, they're taken out and put into a pond, just a swimming pool, basically, to cool down, as in cool in the thermal as well as the radioactivity sense, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. So what will happen is the fuel rods are called Magnox rods, and they basically got a uranium core, which is what's used in the nuclear reactor, and they're encapsulated with magnesium and aluminium alloy. So what happens is after the uranium has been used, it goes into the ponds, as you said, and the uranium decays into other radioactive isotopes, and one of these is plutonium. What they suggest is that because you've got loads of these rods decaying at the same time, you actually have tons of plutonium that you could actually recycle and use. So what they're looking at is trying to recycle this, trying to get this out and use it.
Sure. What's the technique?
They've made their own nuclear storage pond.
So simulate it without having to actually play around with plutonium, presumably.
Well, they have actually put some plutonium in it. So the storage pond that they've made consists of plutonium. Also, some sludge simulant, which includes some magnesium hydroxide, sodium carbonate, polyelectrolytes and some silica. And the magnesium hydroxide has been seen to sequester the plutonium, forming a colloid. And what they found is that using neutral pH or acidic pH, they can actually dissolve the plutonium into a solution and then they can actually filter it out.
I get it. So you have a way of sequestering it under one pH condition. You then filter it off as a solid or extract it as a solid, and then you remobilize it by just switching the pH and you've got your plutonium out.
Yeah, yeah.
And what sort of scale could this be used on? Is this scalable? Could you actually apply this? Would this work industrially?
It is just an experiment at the moment, but it does give indications as to, you know, scaling up in the future. With nuclear power becoming much more important at the moment with carbon emissions and things like that, we need cleaner fuels. This kind of research is becoming more and more important, especially with all the spent nuclear rods that we've got.
Are there any risks, though, Mike? Because obviously one worry is, yes, you might get back X amount of the plutonium, but is there any leakage from the system, as in any that you don't manage to get, and therefore that could be lost or could contaminate things?
Yeah, I think at the moment that's another question that is still out there. The team are going to be doing further experiments to see whether they can actually quantify this and see whether this is actually happening. But it's definitely a step in the right direction.
Mike Brown. Thank you, Mike. If you're a Chemistry World regular, then you might know that in 2008, we launched a sister programme called Chemistry in Its Element. And that set out to tell the story, in weekly instalments, of the elements that make up the periodic table. We've played some of the episodes for you here. But after the periodic table was completed, we then began to take a look at what happens when those elements join together to make the compounds that count. And with the story of 1,3,7-trimethylxanthine, better known as caffeine, here's Catherine Holt.
During the 17th and 18th centuries, some of the most creative ideas in art, literature and science emerged from the coffee houses of Europe. The finest minds of the time gathered daily to imbibe coffee and discuss the ideas of the day. Runners were employed to spread news between coffee shops, so they became an inevitable hub of the community and central to the spread of information and inspiration. Whether such social progress was a consequence of a meeting of minds or the stimulating effect of caffeine can't really be quantified. Perhaps it was a bit of both. I used to think of myself as the modern-day version of the coffeehouse intellectual. A good, strong cup of coffee was required to blow away the cobwebs and sharpen the mind, and the day could not possibly be started without one. But a few months ago, I realised I was no longer drinking coffee to feel good. I was drinking it to avoid feeling bad. I realised I was addicted to the stuff. Addicted to such an extent that I took a cafetiere and a bag of my favourite coffee backpacking with me, because heaven forbid I should be without it even for one day. Enough was enough. I decided to give up this vice entirely. I sustained myself through the withdrawal symptoms, the headaches, the tiredness, the irritability, the aching muscles and joints, waiting for the promised land where I would sleep more deeply, be more focused, concentrate better, and no longer have to plan my holidays, or indeed my life, around the availability of coffee. I read about the evils of coffee on the internet, how it supposedly causes dehydration, indigestion, and most distressingly of all, cellulite. Most of these claims are not, however, backed up by science. Caffeine is a mild diuretic, but studies have shown that it actually has about the same diuretic effect as plain old water, so drinking coffee is unlikely to cause dehydration. Any link between caffeine intake and indigestion also vanishes once other factors, in particular degree of body fat, are taken into account. Caffeine has some structural similarities to another molecule called adenosine. Adenosine accumulates in the brain as a product of various metabolic processes. After prolonged neuronal activity, for example, after thinking or working for a long time, higher concentrations of adenosine build up in the brain. Adenosine is detected by specific receptors, and high levels induce a feeling of tiredness or sleepiness. The build-up of adenosine is therefore a trigger that we should rest or sleep to allow our brain to recover. So where does caffeine come in? Well, its structural similarity to adenosine means it can bind to adenosine receptors, but without triggering them. This prevents the receptors from detecting adenosine, and thus the signal for tiredness is not given. Surely, I thought, giving up caffeine could only be a good thing. It must be better for my brain to regulate itself without intervention. Caffeine is, however, a safe and socially acceptable drug. Almost every nation on earth has their favourite version of a caffeinated drink, from green tea in China to yerba mate in Argentina. The caffeine-containing kola bean has for centuries been used by the people of West Africa to increase energy. The Mayans in South America produced the earliest forms of hot chocolate from cocoa beans, which was so esteemed they were used as a form of currency. Coffee was first drunk in Ethiopia, where the coffee plant grows wild. Legend has it that a goat herder noticed that his goats became sleepless and excitable after nibbling at the berries on the coffee bush. After trying it himself, he experienced the same effects. Whatever the truth of this tale, coffee found its way to North Africa through Persia and eventually to Europe via Turkey. But why is caffeine found in so many different plants? Presumably it's not there to keep the plant awake. Actually, it's a natural pesticide that can paralyse and kill insects that feed upon the plant. The soil around coffee seedlings has also been found to be rich in caffeine. It is believed this may inhibit the germination of other coffee seeds in the vicinity, giving the seedling a better chance of survival. So, how is my caffeine-free existence? To be honest, I have mixed feelings. I enjoy the freedom of being released from my addiction, but I'm definitely aware that something subtle has changed in my brain chemistry. Scientific studies have shown that caffeine increases our capacity for physical work and may improve some aspects of mental performance, for example, memory and ability to focus. Sometimes I think that the caffeine-free me is lacking a little edge. I can't say I've noticed much difference in the cellulite either.
Well, maybe that nonetheless explains my trim, athletic and cellulite-free physique. Or maybe not. That was UCL's Catherine Holt. And if you'd like to meet more of the compounds that count, they're all online at chemistryworld.org/compounds. Now, Andrew, fingerprinting.
Right, so fingerprinting is a very old technique, but it's actually still very important, very relevant for crime scene investigators. But you have an inherent problem in that they're difficult to find, they get all muddled, and they don't last very long. They're just, what they're looking for is the grease that's left behind on the surface.
And then powder sticks to it when you dust.
Right, exactly. So as an alternative, chemists have been trying to come up with other things that they could look for, things that would be left behind. And it turns out there's a wide range of different things they've looked at. In this particular instance, they're looking at amino acids and using nanoparticles, gold nanoparticles covered in antibodies that will stick to these amino acids, and then they've got a fluorescent tag so that you can see where they are.
So who's done this?
So this is a group in Australia at the University of Technology in Sydney, led by Xanth Spindler. What they've found is that using these rigid structures, they can improve the images. They're making them sharper, and they suggest that it's because the rigid structures will distribute more evenly over the surface and give you a nice clean image.
And the application is just improved forensics, or are there other things that this technology could inform or could be used in other ways?
This is primarily forensics. What they found is that using these nanoparticles, they can detect fingerprints and image fingerprints that are over a week old.
Right, which, on any surface? Will it work on any particular surface?
So this, particularly they were looking at non-porous surfaces. The goal with all of this stuff is to be able to detect them on any surface.
And there's obviously skin is the one they really want to get skin as well, because if someone's been strangled or struck or something like that, then it can be quite hard sometimes to get the forensics you need off of a surface contact. But something like that could maybe succeed where other methods have failed.
Exactly. They're looking for a ubiquitous approach that will detect fingerprints on any surface, but also they need to be able to look for something that's always going to be there. And so amino acids fit the bill in this instance. Other molecules they've looked at, they're not always there. For instance, they have looked at molecules that come through from the hair follicles, but you need to have touched your hair before then leaving the fingerprint for these to show up, whereas amino acids, they're always left behind by the fingerprints.
What about the sort of quality assurance of this, or the British kite mark type sanctioning of the use of a new technique like this? Presumably this is an initial observation. It's going to take a bit of work up before we start to see this appearing in courtrooms.
This is definitely proof of concept stuff.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. And Mike, talking of cool stuff, you've found out how scientists have taken a leaf out of what trees do.
Yes, you're right there, Chris. Yanlin Song and his team at the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing have been looking at the poplar leaf to give them an idea of how to create coatings for buildings that can basically reduce your energy consumption in your air conditioning.
Why so, poplar?
Okay, so poplar leaves are quite ingenious in basically keeping themselves cool. On the top side of the leaf, they're green, like any normal leaf. But on the bottom, they appear white.
And yes, I've seen that. When the wind blows, you see a tall poplar tree and it does appear to shimmer.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's because you're seeing both sides of the leaf alternately.
Yeah, that's right. So and what they've got on the underside is a layer of very, very thin hairs. And these hairs reflect light. So in very, very hot weather, in very, very sunny weather, you might actually see poplar leaves actually turning over slightly to reveal the underside of their leaves. The light is then reflected by the hairs on the underside of the leaf, so the heat is reflected away and they're kept cool.
And so the idea is to work out what keeps the leaf cool and then see if we can apply that as a sort of biomimicry type
step in
construction.
Yeah, so they found that the hair's structure, they've mimicked this in polymer fibres, and they've made spun polymer fibres into layers, into thin layers, and the fibres are about 5 micrometres in width, in diameter. So they're quite big, really, in terms of other kind of fibres that you might find that might reflect light. So this basically means that that they reflect most wavelength of light, quite a big section of visible light they reflect. So you're actually reflecting infrared radiation as well, which is obviously where the heat comes in.
So if we can make those fibres, then the idea would be to apply this to a surface so that the surface would behave like the poplar leaf and stay cold.
Yeah.
Or cooler.
Yeah, that's right. So what they've done is they've made their polymer fibres, they've made the coating, and they've applied it to a compound, diaryl ethene, which is a ring structure. When you shine visible light on it, it changes from a closed ring structure to an open ring structure, and it changes colour. It goes red.
Oh, this is like their acid test.
Yeah.
Sorry, mixing metaphors. But so this tells them if their technique is working.
Yeah.
Because if you've got something that changes colour when light falls on it, if it doesn't change colour, obviously you're soaking up most of the energy in the incident light.
Yeah.
With the head.
Yes. Yeah.
What did they find?
So they found basically once they coated the compound with their coating, it didn't change colour. So it didn't go red. So all the light energy was being reflected off the surface. So it was doing the job that it was supposed to. The hope is then to take this on and coat the top of buildings in these kind of coatings. Quite a lot of structures like concrete and things like that our buildings are made out of absorb a lot of heat, and it costs a lot of money and energy to put air conditioning into our buildings to keep them cool. So this is hoped to be a way to actually cut the cost of our air conditioning in the future.
The popular option for the aircon of tomorrow. Thank you, Mike. Well, that's almost it for this month. But before we go, Laura's got a wonderful example of some culinary chemical trivia.
OK, with Easter just having gone, we've all enjoyed a lot of Easter eggs, or at least I have. So I thought we'd actually talk a bit about normal eggs, chicken eggs and soft-boiled eggs.
Another one of my favourites.
I don't know how much you've enjoyed all of the expensive chef-y programmes on TV. I've seen a lot of them, and a lot of them now use water baths. It's called sous vide. But some food scientists have actually shown that if you want to do your cooking of your egg in a water bath and you want to get it to the consistency of mayonnaise, then it will take you 300 minutes at 60 degrees or 30 minutes at 67 degrees Celsius.
Okay, tell us what the technique is and then tell me what the bloody point is.
Well, the technique is slow, controlled cooking in a water bath. A lot of these slightly more experimental chefs have been talking about how if you boil an egg at a very low temperature, so in the mid 60 degrees Celsius, then you can keep a perfect, perfect, beautiful runny yolk. And obviously this helps in kitchens as well, because they can just have them sitting there in a water bath for a long time, pick one out, serve it to you, and you think it's amazing.
And is this true?
It's not actually true. It's actually wrong, because oddly enough, your egg yolk is just made of protein. Protein denaturation actually follows a fairly standard Arrhenius kinetic relationship. So on one hand, you have temperature, and on the other hand, you have time. And so you could have it sitting there, and slowly your egg will become more and more from the mayonnaise-y wobbly side to the harder sort of Marmite, which they've actually... The firm texture of Marmite. They have a wonderful graph involving time and temperature and how long it's going to take you to get to different consistencies. And they do compare their egg to various foodstuffs so that the chefs reading this will actually know what they're talking about.
And the reference for any molecular gastronomists eager to pursue this particular style of cuisine is...
It's Cesar Vega and Ruben Marqueda Prieto in Food Biophysics, and it's out this year.
The invigorating title, Culinary Biophysics on the Nature of the 6X Degree Egg.
Yes.
There you go.
So 6X is because various people are talking about either the 63 or the 65 degree egg. People sort of are trying to sort of do different ones, so they've just said, well, 660-something, that's what they mean by 6X.
My boiled eggs seem to end up like bullets, regardless of whatever I do. Maybe I need a water bath. I shall report back next month and let you know. Anyway, that's it for this time. Thank you to our contributors, Mike Brown, Andrew Turley and Laura Howes, and to our guest, Yifang Chu. Production this month was by Miracentha Lingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientists.com. We'll be back reacting to more top chemistry next month, but until then, goodbye.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.